part of the interview with Harold Saunders by William Burr took place in Washington, D.C. on May 1st, 1987.
I guess there were some differences in how government officials interpreted the revolution. For example, I read that Brzezinski tended to see the Soviet hand behind the scenes. Was there a conflict on how people looked at the revolution and how they interpreted its origins, or differences rather?
I think there were differences. I think there was a school of thought that did tend to see Soviet influence in the revolution, or if not Soviet influence, at least Soviet capacity to move in and influence the revolution once it got rolling. And I think Brzezinski would have been more in that camp. Other people, especially those in the State Department, saw it as essentially a revolution made in Iran.
Did these differences have any kind of policy relevance? Did they make much of in terms of practical policy?
I think you have to put that perception together with other ways of doing business, because I can't really separate that from the people who also had a very strong sense of using force to restore law and order, using the military as a way of solving the problem. And so on. Those, for some reason, those schools of thought tended to come together. It was the person with a strategic perspective who was more inclined to use force, and the person with the indigenous revolution view that tended to look to political solutions such as those we discussed when we talked about fall recommendation.
And this will come up again, I think, during this interview. How would you sort of, from your, I guess you had conversations with Ambassador Sullivan frequently during this time. Did you have phone conversations with him, or was it mostly with cable?
Well, it was mostly cable or a special kind of direct teletype kind of thing we had, which was like a telephone, but wasn't. And it was like a telephone in the sense that you could talk back and forth sequentially, but you did it in teletype rather than by voice.
From those kind of communications, how would you characterize the approach that he took toward the revolution? What kind of policy did he favor? American approach.
He would have belonged in the group of those who saw this very much as a domestic political upheaval, and would have thought in terms largely of political solutions. He talked to the Shah, as you know from telegrams, about the use of force, and I think was persuaded that the Shah meant what he said when he said he did not want to rule Iran in a pool of blood, or words to that effect. But I think later on, of course, when General Heiser was sent to Iran, Bill Sullivan worked hand in hand with him, but I think it was, at that point, it was less a question of finding a military solution than it was trying to work with the military to be the bond that helped make the transition.
We talk about Ambassador Sullivan. I read in Kerry Sixt's book that around early December you sent Sullivan a copy of a draft proposal for something that was kind of close to what Ball was working on, sort of a proposal for an interim regime leading to a new government. Apparently Sullivan responded negatively to this draft. And how would you account for that? Since he seemed to be in the same wavelength in some ways. What was...
I can't remember exactly why he did. I think if I were to speculate from this perspective, as I said, I think when we talked about the Ball proposals themselves, it was very late in the game to be thinking about rearranging the political environment. And we started talking about things like the Ball proposals, things like the Ball proposals back in the previous summer before the Shah rearranged his government in September. So then it might have made a difference by the time Ball was brought in things were pretty far down the line. I think Bill Sullivan just saw chaos in Hillary. Around him and really didn't see how all this could work.
Could that be why President Carter might have rejected the proposal, Paul's proposal to begin with?
I suppose
for similar reasons.
I suppose it's conceivable, although I don't know why Ball would have been invited in to make these suggestions if indeed that was the judgment.
Did you never get a really clear sense of why he?
They just sort of dropped into the void. There was no, he didn't reject them. They just, like a lot of proposals in government, somehow they kind of disappear down a bottomless pit. You never hear from them again.
I found an article in the Washington Post, it's been a few years after these events, around December 14th, at the time that Carter was considering all proposals. Brzezinski drafted a letter to the Shah, urging him, the Shah, to turn the military against the protesters. Do you have any recollection of that letter or discussion of such a draft letter?
I remember it as a, I guess I remember it from Vance is talking about it as a draft telegram to the Shah, and that indeed was Brzezinski's point of view throughout. If I'm remembering the same instance, that telegram ended up being split in two, conceptually speaking, and ended up as an instruction to Sullivan to go talk to the Shah and to talk about this, but I think not to press it on the Shah, to discuss it, but not to push it. And I think that was another one of the instances of President Carter splitting the difference between Brzezinski and Vance, if I remember the episode that you're talking about.
Okay. During the course of December, Brzezinski was joined by Energy Secretary James Schlesinger in proposing the sending of a high-level emissary or envoy to convince the Shah to take a hard line. Again, this is another effort to along those lines. Were you aware of this at the time, about Schlesinger's and Brzezinski's initiative or proposal?
Well, I certainly was aware of Brzezinski's position and recommendations. They came up here and there and again and again. And I don't remember a specific proposal piece of paper that sounds like what you're talking about, but it was something that we were talking about all the time. As a matter of fact, some of the Heiser mission was, in a way, one of the ways of playing that out, and indeed it's because of the two different points of view that Sullivan felt that he was getting bifurcated instructions all the time. One was to push a military solution, and one was to look for something less than to look for a negotiated resolution of some kind. And I think he just felt that he was being pulled back and quick because some of Brzezinski's ideas are being sent directly through to the Shah by telephone to Artashir Zaidi. Sullivan realized this, and sometimes we didn't in Washington.
Around December 19th, as the Shah's military government was collapsing, Henry Precht wrote to a long memorandum arguing, again, that the U.S. should play a role as a midwife in bringing Iran into a post-Shah era. I guess his memo had some significance because it's the first time he'd committed himself to paper at great length to discuss his thoughts about this problem. Do you recall seeing Precht's paper? Or
yeah, and I would be surprised if indeed it were the first time he put those ideas on paper.
The textbook suggested that, I guess. But I don't know if that's true.
I can't think what was on paper and what wasn't, but as I said, I had dinner the night George Ball came to town with him and with Henry Precht, and a lot of these ideas were part of that conversation, so they've been, I think, around the Near Eastern Bureau for some time. I know Gary makes a point of when people put things on paper, but I think Gary himself would acknowledge that a lot of the thinking that goes on around a problem like this isn't necessarily thinking that is only that committed to paper. So I can't tell if it's the first time Henry wrote a memo of this kind. It certainly wasn't the first time we'd had that discussion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got a copy from the captured documents. So it's about 6 pages long, so it took a fair amount of time into it, I guess. But did you show it? Would you have shown it around to Christopher or Newsom? Or it's a cover letter to Ambassador Sullivan, and there's an enclosure.
Well, the letter.
I'm trying to see if you recall if you found a policy relevant at that time or not, or was it discussed or rather or dropped instead? Or,
It's the kind of thing that I would have shown to Vance without making much ceremony of it for his own thinking and reading. Mm-hmm. I can't remember whether I showed this particular one to him or not, but. We were certainly talking at length about this, and as I say, it was exactly this kind of thinking that surrounded our conversation with George Ball, and mm-hmm. I think was consistent pretty generally with the secretaries.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But, so Vance is on the same wavelength, basically.
I feel so.
Yeah.
Given instance, he may have been caught in a discussion with Brzezinski and the president where he might seem to have deviated from that line in some degree, but I would feel that we were all generally on the same wavelength.
During late in the month of December, after General Azari's government fell, or failed rather, the Shah installed Saadiki and then Shapur Bakhtiar as prime ministers. Do you know if Sullivan tried in any way to influence the Shah's decisions on those appointments? Was there any U.S. role in
I don't think there was any role on instructions as a choice between the two individuals.
Now, at the same time, apparently, in late December, from what I've read in Six Book and other places, Sullivan and his staff were secretly making contacts with high-level religious opposition figures in Tehran. According to Six Book also, he did not tell Washington about these activities. Was that largely true? Did he not get
that much? It certainly was very clear after the Revolutionary Government was, or Revolutionary Council was installed when Khomeini came back, that the embassy had indeed been in touch with, I think, we figured something like 85% of the members of the new Revolutionary Council had been in touch before the Shah fell.
And with the embassy?
The embassy had been in touch with them. And come February, March of 1979, we were rather proud of the fact that in contrast to the usual picture of a group of people in Tehran being out of touch, that the embassy was indeed able, with a new government, to pick up contacts with that kind of individual. Yeah.
That's very interesting. I guess as a result of these negotiations, Sullivan proposed a plan, which Vance approved, to make direct contact with Khomeini in Paris.
Right.
The abort of Elliott mission.
Right. Yeah.
Do you remember how Sullivan justified his proposal?
Well, at that point, it goes back to the point I was making earlier about the later Heiser mission. At that point, attention really turned to first in the Ball recommendations to trying to negotiate some kind of broader political involvement internally, and while that didn't pan out, there was then a next step in thinking to consider how one might negotiate some kind of transition from the then present regime to one which would be supported by Khomeini, but a transitional regime in which still a number of people in the moderate center and the secular center would have been involved, rather than simply making a cataclysmic leap from Shah's regime to a Khomeini regime. So the idea of negotiating with the group that was obviously going to be the center of gravity in a new regime took the form of being in touch with Khomeini's crowd in Paris, to see what might be done there. Later on, of course, there was the Kaiser mission, one purpose of which was to see whether the military could be equipped in some way to be the cement that would hold the transition together, encouraging them obviously they represented the past, but also encouraging them to reach out and try to establish some role in an incoming regime so that they could be a bridge in a transitional process.
Did Sullivan see it that way, the transitional process? Because I've gotten the impression that he wanted to stitch together a coalition that could replace, or supplant, rather, the Bakhtiar government. Is that understood at the time? Or?
No, I think so, but the idea when the opposition branded Bakhtiar as the Shah's instrument and therefore unacceptable, then the question became whether or not you could negotiate the formation of a government that might be acceptable to the incoming or the opposition group and yet still preserve elements of the former regime and provide some kind of order in the transition.
Now, according to Sixth account, Sullivan had a plan for the dismissal of the top 100 military leaders in Iran and the replacement by figures chosen by the opposition. Did you discuss this with anybody in Washington?
I don't remember that.
Yeah. I mean, Sixth's pretty hard on Sullivan at times. It suggests at times that he was operating entirely on his own without instructions from Washington. Was that an accurate characterization?
I think Bill Sullivan would put it in terms of not that he wasn't getting instructions from Washington, but he was getting, as I said, divided instructions from Washington, instructions which were internally inconsistent, which conflicted with each other. One line was reflected those moments when Zbigniew Brzezinski dominated the scene and were directed toward a military solution. The others reflected the department's point of view, and it was very clear in the communications with Sullivan from the department that he knew whose instructions were whose, and he didn't have much respect for a certain source of those instructions. Therefore, Sullivan would say it wasn't that he was getting no instructions, but he felt he was out there being whipsawed by two factions in Washington. And I think he, being a very senior and experienced ambassador and having lived in some previous chaotic situations such as Laos and in Southeast Asia, he decided to position the embassy to cope with a transitional situation or a changing situation, if you want to use that word. Yes, I suppose you could say he did some things not acting on instructions. On the other hand, he had a mind of his own, and you know, sometimes that's good and sometimes it's bad, and it depends on usually on how things turn out and what happens afterward and how much sniping there is around among those involved. In this case, there was a great deal of sniping, and a lot of this came out. If Washington had been harmonious and Sullivan had been acting in ways consistent with managing as orderly a change as possible and preserving the American position with the new government, he could very well come out getting an A+. So it's a man takes his initiative in his hands, and he may do so and act very wisely and still be condemned. He may do so stupidly and nobody notices. So in this case, I think that any senior ambassador worth his salt is going to look at a situation around him and take a number of initiatives. I mean, if one steps out of this chaotic situation to another one, namely Beirut, even in the 75-78 period, when while there was a civil war, there at least wasn't the total disintegration of central authority that we know in the mid-80s. But there, I think looking at it from Washington, the only sensible policy was to tell an ambassador that we would like him to operate among factions in Beirut in such a way as to help preserve some kind of coherence around the central authority in Beirut, We in Washington weren't smart enough to tell him how to do that, to whom he should talk, whom he should bring together among Lebanese factions for meetings and so on. I think the same applies in Tehran. You've got a chaotic situation. An ambassador figures that his job is to protect the American position so that whatever happens, when the dust settles, there will still be an American position there to pursue and protect American interests. And I think that's what Bill Sullivan was trying to do, obviously, in putting out his feelers to members of the opposition. He was sensing that he was going to have to, he or these, his successors were going to have to deal with that opposition at some point in the not-too-distant future, and the time then was to begin establishing the foundations for that. Since he had already judged that the Shah's regime was on its way out, it wasn't as if he was going to be jeopardizing the Shah by being in touch. And there are lots of different ways to argue. We could have a very serious and sensible debate over this issue, but I think that was the Sullivan's rationale, and I think it's probably generally consistent with the ethos of the senior, very senior, career ambassador, minister level of the Foreign Service.
That's interesting. Now, apparently, this planned Elliott mission, the planning went for a considerable length before it was finally dropped, or suddenly dropped.
Got right up to the point, as I recall, within hours of his departure.
Did you get a sense why President Carter rejected the plan to send Elliott to Paris?
Well, I never really knew quite what the intricacies were of who talked to Carter or to whom Carter talked and why the decision was made, but it seemed pretty obvious that it was one of those decisions made on the basis that would have seemed a very open casting of the lot with Khomeini. And I think Carter had been conscious throughout that it was one thing to make an analytical judgment that the Shah's days were numbered. It was quite another thing for the President of the United States to indicate in a public way that he had made that judgment. And that I think he felt that it was too open a display of shifting attention. Now, the real argument here, of course, is that if we'd been in touch with the Khomeini camp throughout the year in a normal way at middle levels, then we wouldn't have had to make the judgment at this time. This is a parenthetical statement, but it's another example of how keeping yourself out of contact with people who are ultimately going to have to play a central role in the resolution of a particular situation is a bad idea for a great power. You don't have to like people to talk to them. You don't have to recognize them to talk to them. But invariably, if you don't talk to them, you end up wishing you had. And in this case, we wouldn't have had to have an Elliott mission if we'd had Warren Zimmerman, as we ultimately did, in the embassy in Paris, in touch with the Khomeini camp. If we'd established that channel during the previous summer or spring, the channel would have been in place. We could have had an Elliott go to Paris and normal course of things and elevate the dialogue if we wanted to.
At what point did Washington policymakers, I guess State Department officials and others, start assuming that the Shah should leave Iran?
Well, sometime just about the time, like the last week in December, I guess, is about the period when there seemed to be a cascade of judgments reached. That was the probable outcome and necessity. It was at that time, or a few days later, that people began to think about the alternative scenario, that there was the idea that maybe the military should capture the Shah and carry him to the south and then come back to Tehran and put him on the throne again. It's a familiar scenario from the past.
That was discussed at the White House?
Yeah.
Was was he the advocate of that?
It certainly intrigued him, and I don't want to put thoughts in his head or words in his mouth, but I forgot what his book says on that point, but it certainly was an idea that I remember being discussed around the Situation Room table.
Was there much of a U.S. effort to directly or indirectly encourage the Shah to leave the country?
It was a very touchy thing, and there came a point when the answer to your question would be yes, but it was down toward that very last 4 or 5 days. Then I think we did weigh in to urge it, but we were very late in the game in urging it, simply because of the proprieties and the complexities of making it. Judgment like that on his behalf.
Now, did you have any hand in the decision to send General Heiser to Iran?
Yeah, that was one of these things that came out of the White House complex and was managed between the White House and the Pentagon. The communication with Heiser was through the Pentagon rather than the State Department. The communication with Sullivan was through the State Department directly. And in some places you had Heiser and Sullivan sitting together in the communications room at the other end, and Sullivan sort of typing his message to us and saying, Heiser tells me that he is instructed to, and coming back with his comment and so on. So not exactly one of the best moments of American policy-making coherence.
Apparently, Heiser's options included something that's called Option C. I guess the idea of supporting, encouraging a military coup if Bakhtiar fell or was threatened by the opposition. Was there any support in the State Department for pushing that option? Or
no, I think there was the focus in the State Department on that exercise would have been more in terms of encouraging the military, for instance, to reach out to the Khomeini camp and see whether it could work out its own accommodation with them again, so that you would preserve that core of solidity in the Iranian body politic, but make it the bulwark of a new regime, rather than having it be swept, demolished. And so.
Now, did you or other your colleagues have any? So how much of a chance did you think that the Bakhtiar had by in January? What are the assessments of his prospects for continuing his position?
Well, that's an even, but not not 10%, not as low as 10%. I think people felt it was more a question of how long he could last, rather than whether he could become the center of a governing authority over a longer period of time. I mean, I think we felt the days were clearly numbered, and it became quite apparent that the opposition by that time held the upper hand and wasn't going to have any of him.
So you realized you couldn't carry your support to any great length for Bakhtiar, was that?
Yeah. Beyond, I mean, since he was there, the purpose was to see whether it could be used as the use is the wrong word, see whether he could be the figure in a transitional arrangement of some kind.
Mm-hmm. I guess around mid-January, January 22nd, Sullivan cabled that if Bakhtiar fell, the U.S. should not support a coup and instead encourage the army to reach an agreement with Khomeini. As the alternative supporting Bakhtiar, which I guess diverged from official policy, which was to support Bakhtiar in some way. Did this message have much influence? Or,
well, again, I'm just I'm drawing on easy memory about one message.
Yeah.
But, I think by that time, events were moving with such momentum and speed that a telegram would not have had a tremendous impact.
Mm-hmm. Now, when committee returned around, I guess around February 1st of 79, and he appointed maybe Bazargan as prime minister, which creates sort of a dual power situation in the country. Now, how did you and other officials assess the situation? What kind of options do you think the United States has in this context?
Well, a Bazargan government would have been seen as at least preserving in the Iranian government some kind of representation from an understandable political center, at least a group of secular people who had a tradition which people understood, and that would have been regarded as preferable to an entirely Islamic group. So, and I think it was not long after that that became apparent that the embassy could be in touch with that kind of government, and that if it had Khomeini's support, and since it was a middle ground, it represented the middle ground, that the United States should try to work with it.
You mentioned earlier that Sullivan was having to carry on negotiations with some of the people that were around Bazargan. did you know at the time? At this time, I'm sorry. Did you, the State Department officials discuss at this time the possibility of negotiating with Bazargan to sort of facilitate an orderly transition? I mean, apparently Sullivan was doing that on his own, but did people in Washington encourage that in any way by this point, or was it sort of waiting to see what would happen?
I think it's one of those cases where the events were moving quickly, and you saw what your ambassador on the ground was trying to do, and it was very difficult from Washington to get ahead of the momentum of events on the ground, and it was they who tended to sweep the situation along. The ambassador stayed in touch with it. I don't remember at that point there being a significant policy debate about alternatives. The alternatives were overwhelmed by the rapid developments on the ground.
Now, early in the month, I guess around February 3rd, General Heiser returned to the United States, and he and President Carter met with a number of officials at the White House. Were you present at that meeting?
Close Vance was.
Yeah, I guess one result of the meeting, from what I've read, what counts was that Secretary Vance cabled Tehran that the U.S. was firmly committed to supporting Bakhtiar, and that it supported any action to support Bakhtiar's position. I mean, it was a really strong statement to the embassy in favor of supporting Bakhtiar, basically. Did you at that time think that was a workable approach?
No.
If that was a kind of policy?
No.
I think our sense was that he was really... He would be replaced. He wasn't viable after Singapore.
Did you discuss this with Vance? Did he disagree with you about this issue?
I don't remember any disagreement. I don't know if I had trouble reconstructing any particular discussion at that point. Mm-hmm. You have to remember that in fast-moving situations like that, you end up having a half a dozen quick discussion today, either on the phone or running up to his office, and that's a sort of ongoing dialogue where you may discuss and drop options or reach a consensus on options without ever a paper's having been written, or without your feeling that there's ever been a major policy discussion.
Okay. Now, on the following weekend of February 8th, there was a mass revolt inside the Iranian military, which drew its support to Bazargan and Khomeini. Were there discussions at the White House, the State Department that weekend, as to what to do next?
I'm sure there were, but I can't bring them back to memory, especially. This was a period of several months of one event, one meeting, one discussion after another on a almost quarter daily basis. So the fact that meetings don't stand out in recollection doesn't mean it wasn't intense activity. It just means that the situation was serious, but no one meeting may have stood out over others.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what kind of an approach that the State Department took towards this development, when the military throwing its support to revolutionaries? What kind of approach did the State Department develop towards this transfer of power?
I think generally there was the thought that we were going to have to try to find a way to do business with the new center of power in Tehran, and the attention turned to how to go about that.
How would you characterize the policy approach that the U.S. took during the course of 79 towards the Khomeini regime?
There were several moments, starting at the moment in early February when we had to address this question the first time, when we asked ourselves whether we could do business with the new government, whether we had an interest in trying to do business with the new government, whether the political situation would make it viable for us to sustain a presence, diplomatic presence in Tehran, whether that could be done with at least no more than a reasonable amount of risk to the people involved. And at each stage, and I think that February was one point, sometime in April or May was another point, maybe one or two other lesser points, but certainly late October, after the Shah was admitted for medical treatment in Washington, was yet another point. But again and again, we revisited the basic question, should we try to stay there or not? And generally, the feeling, which I think is normal in a situation like this, is that we're better off present than absent in an important country during a formative period after a traumatic change. So we tried to stay there, even after the embassy was taken over on February 14th, we decided that we would stay there. And as one of the people who was later taken hostage said to me after he came home, that by November we'd been up this hill and argued this thing out enough times that sure, you knew what the dangers of trying to stay were, you knew what the limited advantages of trying to stay were, but on balance you had come down on staying so many times that it would have taken a jarring situation to cause you to decide to leave.
Did you participate in any talks with Iranian officials before November 79? Did you attend any meetings at the UN or other forums where discussions were held?
Yes. There were a number of discussions in the... You know, as the spring wore on, it became apparent that there were a lot of things... It became apparent that there were a lot of areas where we could have could do business one way or another, practical things with the new government. And as the embassy stayed and as contacts developed, it became possible for us to do a number of things. One of the major things that needed to be done was to bring some kind of rationality to the military supply program, which of course under the Shah had been massive, and the new government in Iran was not inclined to continue the procurement at the levels that the Shah had pursued. And yet all this stuff was in some point of passage between manufacture in the United States and Iran. Title had passed, payment had been made, etc. So there's just a massive problem there. The new Iranians in Tehran didn't know what was there and didn't have a clear picture of what the system had been and so on. So there were a number of meetings, for instance, among military specialists in Iran and here, and even in New York during the U.S. General Assembly session in the fall, about issues like that. What, trying to draw some kind of understanding about what categories of stuff that they didn't want. So I I remember sitting in the living room of the Iranian mission in New York when I was up there. Vance saw the foreign minister. I met with him with privately and with some others. Some of them I saw in the embassy in the office in Washington during that year. We tried to operate as governments in normal communication in a not totally normal situation.
Now, in his book, Jerry Sickert is fairly critical of Henry Precht for arguing during the summer of 79 that the position of the Iranian moderates is fairly strong and that the U.S. should pursue a policy of normalization. Now, to simplify Sick's argument, he suggests that because Precht's position was influential, the Carter administration did not take steps to strengthen embassy security. Now, how much of that interpretation would you accept from your recollection?
Well, the first thing is that in the from Precht's point of view, since the judgment had been made by late spring a couple of times that we would be present rather than absent, and the purpose of our being present was to try to help serve a variety of interests, including those of businessmen who needed to sort out their projects in Iran and so on, that it was going to be necessary to do certain things to slightly increase the staff in the embassy. The other side of the problem was that comes late summer, there were going to be a number of Iranian students coming back to the United States, and you needed certain consular services to service their applications and so on. So the inclination of the person having to manage that relationship was to provide the embassy with the capacity to perform those services in both directions. And at the same time, the embassy had been taken over in February once. You couldn't ignore the dangers and to the people there and the security problem. At some point, we went to a policy of having people go out on temporary duty on a volunteer basis to fill in rather than trying to assign people permanently to the embassies. So there was consciousness of a security problem and an effort to talk about it. I'm not, other than reducing the size of people and going to and hardening the embassy in some very unusual ways, I'm not. I don't know what more could have been done that would have prevented what happened in November. The embassy was hardened internally, and the measures obviously didn't stand up to the attack in November. On the other hand, the problem in November was that the Iranian government wasn't prepared to provide protection as it had during the February 14th takeover. So, obviously, there were mistakes in judgment made in retrospect, but if you go back and talk to the people who made these judgments, if you talk to people in the embassy, they would have said, yes, it was a very dangerous situation, but once we had made the judgment to stay, you accepted the fact that the judgment had been made to stay in the light of obvious dangers, and those dangers were reviewed in the couple of weeks before the embassy was taken over. But I think what Gary faults are the decisions to build up the staff of the embassy somewhat so that there were more people there. Well, maybe, and I think some of the hostages probably were bitter that those decisions that they, for instance, that the consular section had been opened and fully staff. She may have had mistakes of judgment.
Did you play any role in the discussions that led to the decision to admit the Shah in October, I guess?
Well, most of the communications came into the department on that subject to David Newsom, the Undersecretary for Political Affairs, and we were very much involved. I think Henry Precht had written a memo way back as early as February or March, I can't remember when, after the Shah initially left Iran, saying that if the Shah came into the United States then, and that was long before we had any notion of the impending medical problem, that there was a danger that the Americans would be taken hostage against the return of the Shah to Iran. And I think those memos had a very strong influence because indeed we urged the Shah not to come, and I think that weighed on President Carter's consciences. So by the time prospect of bringing the Shah to the United States arose, there was a history of memos that argued against his coming. So to that extent, we played our role. Obviously, the recommendations were overruled. Other considerations prevailed.
Did Van Swarthuizen talk with you at this time? Did you talk to you or Precht about the decision?
Sure. We were.